Welcome to Life, Liberty, Reason. I'm James Elias. Thank you for joining my journey through the history of philosophy. Each week, we'll explore the ideas of men in history who have defined the way we think. The sources for the program can be found in the description below the player on Blog Talk Radio. This week, we'll be discussing the cult of Jesus, known to us today as Christianity. During the decline of the Roman Empire, people felt like their lives were not within their own control. This came from the continuous decline of Greek philosophy, how it moved from a confident, this-world-oriented, achievement-oriented philosophy of Aristotle to the mystic or semi-mystic, otherworldly philosophy of Plotinus and other Neoplatonists. The culture in effect in Rome during the early ADs was ripe for mysticism to take over. And there was a series of mystery cults that we discussed last time that did threaten to take over. And it was in fact Christianity, which was the cult that won out in the end, eventually becoming very popular and eventually just becoming the official Roman religion in the year 380 BC with the Edict of Thessalonica. The empire, BT Dubs, fell 100 years later. A general examination of the Roman mystery cults shows us, as we discussed last time, that they're actually really similar to Christianity. All of them had a heavenly father of some kind. They all had some kind of purification ritual in Christianity. This is baptism, when they dump water on your head, and that's supposed to cleanse you of your sins. And they all had some kind of communion ritual where you eat God, and in order to sort of become more holy and come in communion with Him. Philosophically, all of them taught the dirtiness of the body, sort of this, you know, again, the mind-body dichotomy, which is the belief that, you know, the mind is something of another world and is the holy part of man, and the body is the dirty part. And this, of course, has its roots in Plato, who believed that this world wasn't really super real, wasn't really that good, but believed that the mind was good and did have access to the real world, or the world of the forms. This also comes from the Pythagoreans, all the way back there by the Pythagoreans, who got their ideas from their mystery cult religions. And so you can trace the Christian, you know, some of the Christian sins, for example. One of them is gluttony. You shouldn't enjoy food. You shouldn't enjoy, you know, food. Today they say to excess, but we'll see later that the Christians who took their ideas very seriously thought you shouldn't enjoy food at all. You shouldn't enjoy sex. And now today in the Catholic Church, you can see remnants of this, where they say the purpose of sex is procreation, and you shouldn't have sex simply for the fun of it. You have to leave yourself open to the possibility of babies. Again, sort of a mind-body dichotomy, that this world is dirty and that it's all about the other world. And what that leads to is an ethics of asceticism, an ethics that denies pleasure. Christianity, and as a result of this, and so what I just basically described is I described a bunch of things that Christianity got from mystery cults, from these Roman mystery cults that, you know, worship this god or that god, and as I discussed last time, such as Mithraism. And Christianity, I think, can basically be understood as a merging of these mystery cults and their general practices with Judaism, which is a religion, you know, of the Jews, basically. Let's start with Jesus. Jesus was born in 4 BC. Jesus was born 4 years before the birth of Christ. The Jews worshipped, I know. The Jews worshipped Yahweh, which in fact, back in the day, back before this, was the ancient god of war. Basically, what Moses did was he united several of these polytheistic peoples into one big old tribe, which later became known as the Israelites. And the Israelites, according to Moses, were Yahweh's chosen people. This particular God, his chosen people, and they were destined to inhabit the land of Palestine, which is, of course, as we know today, Israel. And of course, it's called Israel after the Israelites, for the obvious reason they ended up getting back there. And so here's something sort of funny is that, if you don't know about Judaism and this business about God having a chosen people, you may remember from Christianity, wait a second, isn't God supposed to be loving everyone? Isn't, you know, he's the dominant, you know, universal creator. And so every single human being is his creation and, you know, he loves all of them. Well, that wasn't really so back in the day of Judaism. Back when Judaism was first being founded, the Jews and all other peoples in that region basically accepted the idea that there were many gods. It just so happened that Yahweh was the god that represented this particular people. So it's sort of, and so it's not that they did not believe in those other gods. It's just that they were only on the side of this one god, Yahweh. And this is actually why you may have wondered about this. I certainly did before I read about this. Is why is it that the Ten Commandments say, "You shall have no god before me, for I am a jealous God." That's the first of Moses' Ten Commandments. Have no god before Yahweh, because Yahweh's jealous. He gets pissed off if you worship the other gods. If Yahweh is supposed to be the only God, you wouldn't really describe Yahweh as being jealous. You'd say, oh, well, Yahweh would be pissed at you for, you know, not worshiping him instead of, you know, instead you're worshiping fake gods. But the idea at the time was, is that you're only supposed to, there's many gods, but you're only supposed to devote yourself to Yahweh. And I guess the idea was, is that each of these different cultures would have a god that sort of represented them. You know, like a football team, basically. And that god's supposed to represent you, he's supposed to protect you, he's supposed to make sure you make it to your promised land, get all your cultural ducks in a row, etc. Well, apparently Yahweh did a pretty crappy job, because even after they found this promised land, the Jews came to be dominated by the Assyrian Empire. And we know from recent history that the Jews have pretty much had a rough time ever since. Let's go back to Jesus. So Jesus himself was a Jew, but he had his own particular spin on Judaism. At this point, the Jewish people had pretty much been occupied by the Roman Empire at this point. It was the Assyrians, and they kind of got tossed around from this empire to that empire. And now it's the Romans who control the land of the Jews. So Jesus had his own spin on Judaism. Jewish law, at this point, had been entrenched for many centuries and had become very technical. You know, you're supposed to do this particular ritual at this particular time. You're supposed to do it in this way, and had a lot of technicalities to it. Jesus reintroduced the idea that the spirit of this Jewish law should be held above the letter of the Jewish law. He thought that people were basically being too worldly by following only the letter of the law and not its spirit. So here's some examples. You can see these examples in the Bible. Jesus argues with these dudes named the Pharisees, which are basically Jewish priest lawyers, basically. They know all the ins and outs of all these laws. They were the guys who were seen as being, you know, overly technical and not really understanding the deeper meaning of the Jewish law. So here's an example. Pharisees say, you got to eat with washed hands. That's what it says in Jewish law. You got to wash your hands before you eat. But at this time, this is kind of gross, unfortunately, but, you know, some people were just too poor to be able to afford to regularly wash their hands. That's poor, huh, isn't it? So they were so poor they couldn't regularly wash their hands. And Jesus basically said, you know, Pharisees, you know, when you condemn poor people for not washing their hands before a meal, you're really not obeying the spirit of the law. Yeah, the letter of the law says that, but it's the spirit that counts. It's the thought that counts. And Jesus say, like, well, it's your spiritual purity that counts, not the physical purity of your hands when you decide to eat. So Jesus, basically took the spirit of the law above the letter of the law. Another example would be, one of the Jewish laws is against adultery. But Jesus famously said, quote, "If you look upon a woman with desire, you have already committed adultery with her in your own heart," unquote. So Jesus is, you could imagine. So, if the Jewish, I'm not exactly sure about the details of the Jewish law, but let's say that the only Jewish law, says thou shalt not commit adultery. Well, that leaves quite a range of things open. All kinds of very interesting things for you to do and still completely follow the letter of the law. Jesus basically reinforced the religious doctrine against sex by saying, no, look, if you're even thinking, about her, then you've already sinned, basically. So he's reinforcing the strong religious ideas against sex. Jesus thought that the end of the world was very close at hand. He thought the world was about to end, basically. Luckily he was wrong. We're still here. But because he thought this, he thought that, you should give away your worldly goods and just stick to the teachings. Just forget about it. Just don't worry about this world. One of the texts I'm reading, it's called The Medieval Mind by W.T. Jones. And Jones had a very interesting, I don't know if he's the one who came up with this, but I wanted to give him credit for pointing out this similarity. A remarkable similarity between Jesus and Diogenes. Jesus basically said, shun worldly desires, don't store wealth in this world. All that matters is your inner righteousness, your inner faith to God. This is really similar to Diogenes. Diogenes, of course, the cynic, Sinos from Dog Philosopher, because he lived on the street like a dog. He didn't have any wealth, he didn't shave, he didn't bathe himself like a friggin' dog. Maybe Jesus bathed himself because, those Jews, I guess the Jews back then were really big on hand washing. So at least his hands may have been pretty clean. But, Jesus didn't have any property. He roamed the streets. He's homeless, basically. You ever read the Bible and get the sense that Jesus was just a big hippie? Well, I mean, it's a very similar mindset to that of Diogenes. Diogenes said, all that counts is your mental state. So therefore, you should focus all your goals on making sure your mental, your mind is healthy. Make sure that you have good premises. Make sure you're committed to the good upstairs in your head. But, once you've committed to that, forget it. Everything else doesn't matter. Again, this mind-body dichotomy, even quite comedically, extends to the field of personal grooming. So let's see here. So again, what matters is your inner state. And here are some of the, and Jesus professed his morality during the Sermon on the Mount, where he said that the essence of morality is essentially love, and which means, so basically, like, if you were to take one principle and integrate all of Jesus's teachings together under one idea, you get the principle of love. You are to love God, and as a result of that, you're to love your neighbor. Basically, I guess that means all people. This, in Christianity, this ended up getting extended to all people, but maybe Jesus was just such a primitive thinker that, he couldn't think much further than the neighbor. I'm not sure why they say neighbor, so I'm gonna just, table that one. But I find it interesting that he said neighbor. There must be some kind of historical reason he says neighbor instead of love other people. Today we would certainly say love other people, not just your neighbor, because your neighbor's like, 20 people max. So let's see. What are some of the other virtues that Jesus taught when he was on the Mount, given that sermon? He taught what matters is your inner state, total humility, never strive to be great, unlimited forgiveness, judge not lest thee be judged. This means no assertion of yourself, no assertion of your own wants in this world. Charity, love thy neighbor as thyself. Give everything you own away, or sell it rather, and then give that money to the poor. Faith, trust not upon your own understanding. Believe in God. A total rejection, a total death of the Greek mindset that we are to figure this world out with our own minds. No, we must not lean upon our own understanding. We must give it over to another dimension. The reason I'm saying this is because Christian morals, it's hard to get a sense of Christian morals because, of course, Christians surround us all the time. In fact, you yourself might be a church-going Christian. But I want to emphasize that the Christianity that anyone listening to this podcast right now is seeing today is nothing like the actual consistent teachings of Jesus. I'm going to repeat these virtues, and I'm going with an emphasis this time on how no one today really lives up to them. And in some sense, this is, and in a very real sense, this is a very good thing, because the ideal Christian, as Jesus teaches, would not be a very admirable person. Even by today's standards that Christians hold, I think if you were to really take Jesus' ideas seriously, I don't think it would appeal to anyone. So let's start off again with these virtues. Humility. Do not think highly of yourself. Do not assert your own importance. For example, as Jesus did, you know, going up there on a frickin' hill and telling everyone how to behave. I mean, that seems like he thought he was pretty important. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I regularly just talk in front of a microphone. I assert my opinions all the time for, you know, hours at a time in front of this microphone. But I think that's, you know, I'm following that because I think that's a good thing. Jesus did that as well, but this contradicts his virtue to act humbly, to believe that, you know, just don't assert your own importance. What this really means is don't assert your own ideas. Right off the bat, we have basically a set of ideas that are impossible to practice. If you follow all these virtues, then you are going to feel that you're good. You know, the Romans, they were allowed to sacrifice and do their duty to the Roman state and feel a sense of stoic pride at their achievements and their, you know, your battles that you've achieved for the Roman state, or, you know, building aqueducts, or, you know, whatever it is you did for the Roman state. You're allowed to feel pride in that duty. But no, not so for the Christians. For the Christians, you are still to be humble. You are not to assert yourself, which means, to begin with, you probably just shouldn't achieve anything to begin with, because then you'll get too big for your puny human britches. Anyway, let's go to the next virtue. Forgiveness. Judge not, lest thee be judged. Well, so we're not supposed to judge people, basically. If someone does something wrong, you are not allowed to condemn them. You know, let thee who is without sin be the first to cast the first stone. That's what Jesus said, basically saying, well, you know, you're not allowed to judge other people unless you yourself are perfect. Well, then basically what this does is it gives everyone a license to just be as evil as they possibly can, because no one's going to be going around judging them for fear that they're going to be judged as evil. You know, like, oh, well, you know, this person, you know, killed someone. So, I've done some bad things, but I'm going to throw the first stone. They deserve to die they stoned people to death back then. So, you know, I feel like, you know, people who murder deserve punishment, so I'll throw the first stone. No, says Jesus. You're not allowed to judge, because on some sense, you are imperfect, just like this murderer, because, you know, yesterday I saw you looking at, Sophie, and when she was, you know, going to the well, you were looking at her, or whatever. Another part of this whole forgiveness thing, you know, turn the other cheek. If someone slaps you in the face, just, you know, give them the other side of your face to get pummeled. To me, that just means pacifism, which basically means you're not willing to stand up for what's right. This whole forgiveness mentality completely sacrifices justice. I think a true Christian in the way Jesus saw it would never be the type of, you know, Republican Christian you see today who says, like, we got to defend America. And, you know, I mean, I think it's good to defend America, but it's not Christian. It's totally not Jesus-like to want to defend America. Maybe later, you know, Christian teachings did say that there's a place for violence, and they certainly did with Thomas Aquinas' just war theory. But the early Jesus, you can see from this statement, well, the personal virtue appears to be pacifism. He said, the meek shall inherit the earth. The meek are those who really, you know, they don't trust at all in their own achievements and their own greatness, and so they just are zombies who are able to completely give their souls over to God. That's really what this Christian morality wants you to be, a slave to the will of an invisible man. Every part of this morality is here constructed to destroy you as a person, so you that you may hand over yourself to another dimension. Charity, you know, basic, again, like, you know, not just, you know, help other people out when you can. No, give away everything, destroy your life, destroy your material well-being here on earth and give it to other people. Which is kind of funny because I guess all these other people who are gaining it, like, are they just supposed to give it away now? Or is it cool if they enjoy all the free goodies you gave them? No answer. Faith. Again, I think we covered this. Basically, this is destroying the self only on the epistemological level. Your mind is worthless. Your ability to figure stuff out is nil compared to the power of God. So just submit. Submit on the material level and give away your stuff. Submit on the moral level and never assert your own opinion of what you think is right and wrong. Submit on the cognitive level. Have faith and never rely on your own opinions. So that is a that's my treatment of Jesus's ethics. You can tell I'm not a fan. Jesus's philosophy emphasized love above all else. We already covered that. Some believed that Jesus would be this big political leader. They called him the Messiah, which in Greek means, is it Greek or Hebrew? I forget. It's in some other language and it means the King of Israel, basically. You know, basically they saw him as like basically the one. If you've seen The Matrix, the main character Neo is supposed to be the savior of humanity. And he's born and then they dig him up and they say, yeah, he's the one. He's the one who's going to save us. So they, or from Terminator, there's John Connor. And he's a big military leader who ends up saving humanity against the takeover of the Terminators, of the evil machines. And so Jesus is basically seen like this. He's supposed to bring back the Jewish state, free them from the Romans, because the Jews, again, they were under Roman rule, and they'd been under Syrian rule before that, and all kinds of other people just kicking them around. No, this dude, he's back. He's, you know, he's sent directly from Yahweh himself, and he's going to, you know, conquer all of our military enemies, and Israel will be a state again. So it was probably a real letdown when he got executed at the age of 33. His disciples, probably in some kind of depressed fever dream, claimed to see him after he died. And so this is where we get the idea of the resurrection. His disciples after him, you know, basically said, oh yeah, he came back to life after that. And again, and this is very similar to the Roman mystery cults. They had a festival where God would die during the winter, and then when the winter ended, he would be reborn. And so the idea is that God has the ability to laugh in the face of death, to defy death, and, you know, die, come back to life, do it again, whenever he wants. And so the cult of Jesus continued past his death, placing greater and greater emphasis on Jesus the individual instead of his particular religious teachings. The resurrection gave followers the idea that Jesus was not some anointed leader, but somehow this divine being. And someone who was super important in the early founding of the church after Jesus' death was Paul. Paul was originally very anti-Christian. He would go from land to land, killing Christians as heretics. Remember, Christianity is basically started as a sect of Judaism, and you know, people who don't believe in the usual Judaism, they're probably seen as, you know, kind of crazy people who, you know, and their beliefs were to be condemned. So, Paul's riding his horse around, seeking out Christians to destroy them, until one day he falls off his horse and, has some kind of mystic vision. And then he, I think if my Bible serves me right, if I remember my Bible, then, God comes down and he says, "Paul, why do you persecute me?" Or it's something like that. And Paul's like, "Yeah, man, I shouldn't be persecuting him, man. Like, I shouldn't." And so somehow, you know, the dude coming out of the sky just convinced him. Like, by the way, you know, just to point something out, like, so this mystical revelation suddenly caused Paul to just totally be Jesus's biggest fan. He went from persecuting Jesus to suddenly just being his biggest fan, and it's all because of this mystic vision. I really question today if someone today, like most people today, had a mystic vision, what you'd think of it. I think literally a lot of people, if they saw something like this, if you literally saw a dude descend from the sky, like, how many people would really think it was God? You know, it's something interesting to think about, because we think about things so much differently today. This actually reminds me of an episode of Star Trek where an alien comes down to a planet in the form of that planet's version of Satan, basically. And she comes down to the planet and she does all these magic tricks, and they think, oh my God, she's Satan, and she's here to claim our souls. So they actually surrender to her, because that's part of their weird-ass religion there. And it turns out she was just basically the equivalent of an intergalactic con artist. She was just a regular alien. So, you know, it makes me wonder, and why did she succeed? Is because this culture was primed to give itself over to some kind of mystical power. And so apparently Paul was somehow primed for this. And when he had this mystical revelation, whether it was, a bad fig that morning, or whether he hit his head, coming off the horse, he just decided, I'm all about that Jesus now. About that Jesus. So Paul, was the rock upon which the Catholic Church was built. And he made some very interesting doctrinal decisions. One of them was he decided that you don't got to be a Jew to become a Christian. You don't have, so the idea here is, Jesus was a Jew, and, you know, basically if you want to be a follower of Jesus, the idea is like, okay, first you have to enter into the covenant with Yahweh, which involves, cutting parts of your male genitalia off, this practice is called circumcision, and it's still being conducted in some primitive nations. Oh, wait. Anyway, so so Paul basically said, you don't got to be a Jew first. You can just, even if you're a Gentile, which means non-Jew, you can come right in. You are saved just by accepting Jesus. If you believe in Jesus, that we let you right in. He stressed, even above the Jewish religion, the wickedness of the body, especially sex. Paul seemed to be very anti-sex. This is just one of the many ways in which Christianity represents a blend of the Hebrew religion with the mystery cults of late Rome, which, again, as we said, taught a strong mind-body dichotomy. Christianity stresses the mind-body dichotomy far beyond Judaism. And this can basically be chalked up to a blending between the mystery cults and Judaic law. contrary to Jesus, who taught that man could sort of be good on his own, he talked about all these ways, you know, you can submit, you can have faith, you could do all these things that make you good as an individual person. Paul actually went, if this was even possible, Paul went an even further step to establish man's helplessness. If the Jesus ethic that I gave you early doesn't seem enough like a pitiful, helpless ethic to begin with, Paul's is even more helpless. And basically, man is unable to really free himself from sin on his own. It's a free gift. Like, basically, your salvation is a free gift from God. You did not earn it by, you know, following the laws of submission. But he just gives it to you. You can only be saved by total devotion to Christ. In this sense, Christianity became more of a cult than an ethic or religion. And it's at this point during the founding of the church that it was decided that Jesus was not the Messiah, but in fact, he was the Son of God. The whole purpose a rational man might say, maybe my religion's wrong because, you know, our Messiah got completely, you know, friggin' executed. Instead of sort of doing that and beginning to doubt religion, the followers of Jesus decided, oh, wait, this must have been part of the plan all along. So they cooked up this story about how, like, okay, you know, basically we're all sinners and Jesus's sacrifice that, you know, and Jesus intentionally made sure that he got killed up on the cross, and this suffering on the cross is considered is basically his sacrifice that cleanses us of our sins. The mechanics of this sacrifice and how it's supposed to cleanse us of our sins is not elaborated upon. You know, if God really was all-powerful, couldn't he just, good, you're good, guys. Sins, totally cleansed. You know, no, he had to send down his own son and make him suffer for hours of agony while he died as a human being. He had to do that, and that's how you, you know, forgive the sins. Just to sort of, and I know this is probably very offensive to you, if you yourself are a churchgoer and you're listening to this, but like, and I certainly have my own opinions about Christianity being, and I certainly have the opinion that Christianity is a bad philosophy that's very destructive to your life here on earth. But I'm really on some level, I'm trying to just provide an objective historical account of what's going on. To sort of provide more of this perspective, I want you to think of the following, how your philosophy, your personal philosophy, will cause you to take certain events. In the book, A Song of Ice and Fire, this is a book about a medieval kingdom. There is a comet one day. This comet stays in the sky. A red, beautiful red comet stays in the sky for many months at a time. And everyone's got their own opinion of what this comet means. One dude says, oh, you know, God's pissed at us. Then there's this fire priestess, and she says, oh my God, this means that the fire, you know, it's red, you know, red like fire, you know, it means the fire god is finally chosen his servant to come and cleanse the world of evil. So that's what the fire priestess says. Then there's a dragon queen, and she says, oh my God, you know, this comet must mean that it's my time to take control of the kingdom. You know, it's a sign that the dragons are back, that the dragons will once again rule. And everyone's got their own, everyone's got their own opinion of what this means on sort of the grand magical, they all have this opinion of what it means on the grand magical levels. But in today's world, what would we, you know, with our scientific minds, what do we know? Oh, it's a comet. And then, you know, the average dude on the street, he knows what a comet is. It's a big frozen chunk of rock flying around the sun. And the average dude in the street would say, I wonder why it's red. You know, maybe it gives off, you know, a certain chemical and that's red. Or maybe it's on fire. You know, I don't know. Like, they would know, like Thales knew, that there was some kind of rational explanation for why it's red, why it's there. But to a primitive mind, they look up at this comet and they say, oh, it means, you know, that the fire god is back and he's back with a vengeance and, you know, whatever, all this weird ass, you know, mystical stuff. And you can see this same kind of thinking applied to the events of the Bible. Basically, our Savior is crucified for being a rebel. And what does that mean? Well, oh my God, like this totally goes against everything we thought, but we have to find some kind of meaning in this. Well, no, there is no meaning. You know, people were intolerant of your weird-ass beliefs because of their weird-ass beliefs. So they killed your leader. There's no meaning to it. But the primitive mind, the mind that does not think as Thales does, the mind of this late Roman civilization doesn't think of things this way. It always tries to find meaning in all the events of history because, you know, these events have some kind of meaning. They don't just happen because people chose to act a certain way. They happen because God has some kind of divine plan. Understanding this difference of how modern man thinks and how the men of, the first century thought really, it really opens your eyes to two things. It makes you realize, like, first of all, that like religion is a very strange carryover into today's world. Like today's world does not think as religion does at all, and so it's actually quite surprising that religion is even around at all. But you will notice that religion is not around in its pure form anymore. People are not nearly as serious about their religion as these early Jews were, or rather these early Christians were. One easy way to show this is that if you compare the number of people who believe in God to the number of people who regularly attend church, the numbers are quite different. Which, you know, if you really took religion seriously, then if you really believe in God, like, shouldn't you be attending church every week? Because if you really believe in God, then, you know, basically, I guess what this means is that the majority of people who believe in God also believe they're going to hell. But that's just not the case. I think they just don't think about it. So, you know, they don't come to the conclusion, oh, well, I'm going to hell because I don't go to church enough. Anyway, so that's one thing makes you realize. The other thing makes you realize is just sort of, how, you know, religion gets started. It's a certain mindset, and then it interprets particular events to mean certain things. And then that's how they come up with the particulars of a religion. And that's how, and now we have all these ceremonies centered around, you know, the Christians have a holiday commemorating the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. This is called Easter, where they, you know, pound the Easter bunny's ears into a cross and let him hang there. Okay. So, that was a total rant, by the way. I'm totally lost on my notes. So Paul, again, contrary to Jesus, wanted to emphasize man's helplessness here on earth and how basically God's grace can only be given to you as a free gift just if you accept him. It can't be earned by being a good person, by, devoting yourself to him here on earth. By following Jewish law and doing all these particular ethical things like giving your stuff to charity and things like that. It can't be earned. It has to be given to you. And I don't really know Paul's intentions in this sort of theological shift. But I know one thing I have noticed reading about all this is that all of the changes that Paul made to Christianity seem to transfer all the power away from the individual and towards Jesus, or in this case, him, Paul himself, because, you know, Paul was Jesus's representative here on earth. And so you'll notice very, you know, that this essentially, I think, if my interpretation is correct, and I have to emphasize, I'm not an expert at stuff like this. This is my first pass through all these ideas. So a lot of this is just based on, you know, limited knowledge. But I've noticed that, number one, Paul said you don't got to be a Jew first to be a Christian. And number two, you know, your personal ethics don't count for much. All that counts is your submission to Jesus. Both of these things firmly consolidate all the power in the hands of the early church. The early church, in effect, has a monopoly on the goods of the spiritual realm. And I don't think that's... And that's just too much of a coincidence to not be on purpose. So this transfers all of the philosophical, spiritual power directly into the hands of Paul. So, you know, and I think, and it would not be the first time that religion is used as a tool to basically gain power over other people. So let's continue with the forming of the early Christian doctrine. One reason for the success and widespread dominance of Christianity is that it was a coherent religion. Early on in the church, they were getting all these revelations just pouring in, like people saying, oh yeah, I saw Jesus and, you know, my popsicle melted and he refroze it. I'm kidding, but like all these people just writing in about like, oh yeah, Jesus, he did this, he did that. The early church formed a canon early on. They basically said, this is the true revelation, this is not. The reason they did this is because there was all kinds of crazy derivatives of Judaism. There were Cainites who worshipped Cain, which, according to the Jewish Bible, was the first murderer. So, you know, I don't know why they were worshipping a murderer, but, you know, they did. There was another sect that worshipped the serpent in the Garden of Eden. You know, the serpent who tempts Eve into eating the apple. That sounds kind of like a badass religion. You got an evil snake god. I don't know. That just seems kind of metal to me. But anyway, they got all these crazy religions. Oh my God, guys. They basically saying, oh my God, guys, like we gotta standardize this. So what they did is they set a certain a number of canonized documents, and these became the Bible. And everyone else who believed in all that other BS, that's heresy. Because, of course, when you use faith as your, you know, epistemological system, it's pretty hard to distinguish truth from falsehood because everything's basically magical stuff that has no proof. So you need to have this very set, this very rigid set of documents that the truth actually flows forth from. And so that's basically how the church became so powerful, is because it had this very particular set of ideas, and it said anything outside of that, that's a heresy. We condemn it, and therefore you're not part of the church if you don't believe in this set of documents. And so what this did is it's very easy to distinguish between Christian and non-Christian now. And so this is a big deal for any movement, is you got to be really, and not just irrational ones like Christianity. Any movement has to be very stern about what is its belief and what isn't its belief, because otherwise it gets watered down real quick and then it sort of loses its identity over time. I think this may be the major difference between Eastern and Western religions. From my minor experience with Eastern religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, like, they're extremely inconsistent, really hard to pin down, and there's no centralized authorities, no large-scale centralized authorities in the same way, you know, we got a Catholic Church, which is a giant centralized authority. No Eastern religion has this, and I think it's because they, for lack of a better word, were very tolerant. Like, oh yeah, you believe in, you know, the teachings of Confucius and Buddha? That's cool, man. Pass the doobie. Like, that's kind of how Eastern religions seem to me. So, even though Christianity started out as this primitive mystery cult, it started to spread through Rome, started even to spread into high society, you know, by the 300 ADs, it started even spreading into the elite. It started to demand, and because of this, you know, basically smarter people started becoming Christians. It eventually demanded more of a philosophical systematization. And and it is during this phase that Christianity passed from basically a primitive mystery cult, as I've just been describing and criticizing, to a fully fledged philosophy. These philosophers borrowed heavily from Plato and Plotinus in order to come up with, I won't say logical, but systematic arguments for their beliefs, and interconnections between these various dogmas and roots in, you know, the Platonic forms. So join us next week as we talk about the first Christian philosopher, Augustine, who completed this fusion of Platonic rationalism with Christian mysticism.